So I'm Jack Stilgo. I'm a lecturer in science policy here at UCL's Department of Science and Technology Studies. And today I'm joined by Gloria Laycock, who is the Jill Dando Professor of Crime Science here at UCL. And we're going to talk about the relationship between researchers and policymakers and, in Gloria's case as well, the police. Gloria, I was about to give you your own biography, but it makes sense for you to explain the sort of breadth of experience that you bring to UCL, if you will.
Right. Well, I started life as a prison psychologist for 10 years. Then I escaped from Wormwood Scrubs and went to the Home Office Research Unit, and I stayed there for over 30 years and ended up as head of police research. Then left on a couple of scholarships and ended up in 2001 at UCL to set the Jill Dando Institute up.
And what was the thinking behind the Jill Dando Institute at that time?
The impetus came from Nick Ross, who was Jill Dando's co-presenter of BBC Crime Watch. And he wanted to do something because of an absolute frustration with criminology. He's extremely critical of it. He doesn't think it's contributed anything to crime control. And he wanted something more scientific. And he and Jill Dando's colleagues and her fiancé at that time raised £1 million, and UCL was invited to set up the institute and were given that money to do it. And I was appointed as its first director in 2001. So I also had some frustration with criminology. I'm not a criminologist, I'm a psychologist. I actually was educated at UCL. Mm. So I did a lot of experimental psychology there many years ago. And so my sort of background is science and experimental science, and I was very sympathetic to what Nick Ross was actually trying to do. He too actually is a psychologist by training.
Yeah, so even though you say your background was science, I mean, you had spent many years working at the heart of government inside the Home Office.
Yes, I was, when I left, as I said, I was head of police research, and I had responsibility for a very large research budget, which we tried to spend on doing experiments. Much of it we couldn't. Much of it was reviews of things and putting together advice for policy people on this and that. But basically, working with the police and trying to help them do a better job, trying to find out what works, if you like, and particularly how to reduce crime.
Okay. And would you say then that you were a sort of a policymaker? Had you gone native inside government?
Well, I never thought so. I mean, I always thought I had three hats, and it depended on who I was talking to as to which hat I wore. So I think the policymakers saw me as an honorary policymaker, and the police thought I was, as researchers go, I was okay. And the researchers thought, you know, I did have a few publications, and they did have a PhD and things, so I must have been properly a researcher. And I was fine with the ambiguity that came with that, because it meant I could talk to all of them and they'd tell me things that they wouldn't if they thought I was one of the other people.
And is your sense that there's a sort of a suspicion and misunderstandings among the rest of the time?
I think there are all sorts of misunderstandings, but they come from cultural differences. Mm. Just to take the police and academics as an example, I mean, the police pride themselves on being a gung-ho, Geronimo kind of organisation, that they don't wait to think, they just charge off and they respond. And that's what they're supposed to do. I mean, if we dial 999, we don't want someone thinking about whether it's a good idea to get in the car and come or not. Academics, on the other hand, are far more thoughtful and weigh the pros and the cons and think about things, and so their whole background is different, and so they're very culturally very different. And it's the same with policymakers, who see themselves, certainly in the old Home Office, as their job was to protect ministers, to develop government policy, to give impartial advice, and they did that, I think, as well as they could. But it was again very different culturally, because researchers would be concerned about what they would regard as the truth, and policymakers would be concerned about what they would regard as politic, and they're not necessarily the same things.
And there's an important challenge here, isn't there? Because I think academics quite often express frustration at what they see as, you know, if they produce a body of evidence that they feel is truly persuasive,
yes,
and suggests that there is a sort of a right answer to a difficult social problem.
What I think they forget is that what's right isn't the only determinant of policy. The science isn't the only determinant of policy. There's precedent, there's cost, there's what the media will say, there's public acceptability. And it's not irrational of a minister to say, well, I hear what you're saying, scientists, but I just can't do that.
And so you
need to know that. And if you want to get your research results actually used, you need to think, how am I going to make this case so incredibly persuasive that they can't ignore it? And that goes beyond just talking to them and saying, hey, look, here's the facts. It means actually thinking, what pressures can I bring?
So does that mean that academics should endeavour to understand the political context, or should they just be a little bit less, they should expect rather less of their results?
Well, it depends on the academics. I mean, some academics are just so buried in their subject and they really are blue skies, and I've absolutely no problem with that, and the research councils quite properly fund that kind of research. But if you're in, say, the social sciences particularly, if you want to influence policy, if you want to change the world, and we do, we're in the engineering faculty, it's about changing the world at UCL. That's what our dean wants us to do, and that's what we want to do. If you want to do that, then I think you do have to understand that policy context, and for that matter, the practitioner context, the real world in which the police are trying to operate. Mm.
And are there particular issues in your area, in the area of crime, and particular crime prevention, where it is frustrating that the evidence appears to point in one direction and politicians stubbornly face the other direction?
Yes, I mean, I think the really big one is the fact that the public, everybody really, thinks the way to control crime is to have an efficient and effective criminal justice system and arrest offenders. And actually, the way to prevent crime is to change the situation, to change the world. Because for every 100 offences committed, for example, the public only report half of them to the police. And of that, only about 30 get recorded. And they only solve about 7. So thinking you can reduce crime by using the criminal justice system is never going to work. You've got to think about prevention. And that means changing the design of things or systems or management structures. And that's thinking like an engineer thinks, or thinking, if you like, a bit more deeply about how scientists think and testing hypotheses.
I imagine that's a rather difficult political case to make, though. I mean, it's one of those things where, as in health, you know, the successes of prevention are rather invisible, and the successes of treatment might be more public.
Well, they always want to know, has crime gone down? And actually, when I was in the Home Office, we did get some huge reductions in car crime, for example, has dropped by 70% over the last 10, 12 years, maybe a bit longer than that, actually, maybe 15 years. And the reason is because in 1992, the manufacturers put deadlocks and immobilizers on all vehicles. Now, the only reason they did that was because the Home Office published a car theft index which ranked the manufacturers by make, and nobody wanted to be at the top of that list. So they all put deadlocks and immobilizers on cars, and over the following 10 or 12 years, crime dropped steadily, theft often from vehicles. So if you want to reduce the top line of crime, you need to think differently. By all means, catch offenders, obviously, and particularly some of the low-rate offenders like homicide or, you know, serious crimes, violence and so on. You need to catch them. But for relatively less severe crime like shop theft, you're never going to catch them. You've got to think about prevention.
Mm. And you mentioned earlier that academics quite often have a sense of what's right, which I guess, you know, what's right in the sense of a true rather than false. But there's also, I mean, in the political, the moral sense, what's the right thing to do? And I mean, one of the things that we've seen in the last 20 years or so, I remember Tony Blair's famous dictum is what's right is what works. And the rise of evidence-based policy, supposedly, where, you know, people like you and researchers in general would expect to get a better deal from that sort of thing. Do you see things getting better in that regard?
I do, actually, but I think it's far more sophisticated view of the world now. I mean, when I said right, it's only right for now. We might get a better right later. It's the best approximation, because science isn't about what's right. It's about what works, in a sense. You know, somebody's theory is fine for now until somebody else's theory replaces it. I think what's interesting about the current sort of political situation is this realization that the medical science has made huge strides in terms of taking advantage of evidence. And the other areas of public policy haven't been quite so responsive to the evidence. It's very interesting, actually, because if you go to dinner, around the dinner table, and you say, well, I've got something wrong with my stomach, someone will say, go see a doctor. They won't say, well, I know what it is. But if you say, I was burgled, they'll give you chapter and verse on what the, you know, what should be done about it. In other words, there's no sort of acknowledgement that there might be a body of knowledge about crime and crime control, and that the man on the around the dinner table doesn't actually know what that knowledge is. The fact is, there isn't that much knowledge. Well, there's lots more than we think there is, but it's buried in the research literature. And I think what the What Works centres are trying to do, which the government's in the process of establishing, one of which is on crime reduction, is intended to sort of dig out that evidence and present it in a much more understandable and usable way to practitioners and to policymakers.
So that much as a doctor can find meta-analyses of the evidence on a particular thing, a policymaker should be able to come to you at the What Works Centre and say, how do I stop antisocial behaviour in East London?
Yes, and I'm glad you said East London, because I think what they need
it's where
to...
where I live.
Okay. The reason I say that is because how you stop antisocial behaviour in East London might be very different from how you stop it in Lincolnshire or Liverpool or somewhere else. In other words, there is nothing that works everywhere. The context matters, basically. Mm. And so it isn't a bit like medicine where you, even the medics would argue with this, but simplistically you might have said, here, take this pill and everything will be fine, no matter where you live. It's not like that in our area. What we're looking for are people who can make better informed judgments, and they are going to still have to make judgments, but it needs to be based on some sort of evidence, not just, well, my gaffer did this and I'm going to do the same, or we did it like this, you know, for the last 50 years, so it must be the best thing to do.
And one of the things that we've seen additionally, so the What Works Centres is, I guess, one of the new innovations, and there appears to be, within parts of government, a sort of renewed enthusiasm for the idea of experimenting, for taking a more scientific approach to other areas of public policy and trying to see if you could take it to the next level almost and organise a randomised control trial for particular policy measures. Is that something that would apply to crime?
Well, it's such a contentious issue, this randomised control trials in our field. My feeling is that and the randomised control trial is called the gold standard, and in medicine it's the gold standard for experimental research. I don't think it's the gold standard in our world. I mean, I think the gold standard in science is to say, what's the hypothesis, and what therefore is the best methodology to test that hypothesis, which may be a randomised control trial. It may not. But what you want to do is use the best methodology you can and then replicate it. Now, randomized control trials are great in medicine because usually the unit of analysis is the individual. You're giving a bunch of people a pill and a bunch of other people you're not giving the pill to, and you randomly allocate them to the two groups. It's not like that in crime. If you want to say, how do we make car crime go down? It's not about randomized control trials. It's about redesigning the cars. And we couldn't say to Ford, well, you redesign yours, but Vauxhall aren't allowed to because we're doing an experiment. It's just not going to happen. They all went off and redesigned their cars, BMW, Honda, everybody, because nobody wants to be at the top of that list. So you're using a different way of assessing the evidence, and you're taking a longitudinal look at it. Basically, in England, there's no control group because it's happening everywhere. And you can watch crime steadily decrease over a period. You can watch the age of those cars that are stolen getting older and older, because it's more and more difficult to steal new cars because they're the ones that have got target hardening on them. So there's all sorts of evidence you can get to support your hypothesis, but a randomised control trial in that context isn't it.
Mm. And because the situation is so complex, because context change.
Context so. Matters. And you need to think about the mechanism. How is this working? And medics quite reasonably, I think, in the old days, as it were, didn't know what that mechanism was. So when Snow worked out what caused cholera, and it was water coming out of a particular well, he didn't know that it was a cholera virus in the well. He didn't know what caused it. He just knew if you drank water from that well, and therefore it was the water. Let's deal with that. But now we can be much more specific about mechanisms. So we can say, well, the reason my house isn't going to get burgled is because I've target hardened it and I've made it much more difficult for a burglar to get in. The mechanism is increasing the effort and increasing the risk to the burglar who's making a decision.
Gloria Laycock, thank you very much.
You're welcome.